So again, we visualize in front of us, just imagine, best we can, the presence of enlightened energy, if you think of it this way, manifesting in this green female form, the manifestation of all the qualities of an enlightened being, but the aspect is kind of like this one of power, action, energy, action, often depicted as female, actually. And green light body, green is sort of like action energy, it seems. Sitting in this bodhisattva style, left leg drawn in, the lower part of her body, multicolored silk, you see in the pictures. Right leg out, resting on a multicolored lotus, sitting on a multicolored lotus. Everything's radiant light, dazzling light, very beautiful. And they say about all these aspects of the Buddha, they're all in the prime of their youth, about 16 years old, looking very gorgeous. And the whole idea is to energize us, to energize us. And I think her face, very beautiful. If you have a spiritual teacher, you think it's their mind manifesting in this aspect for your benefit. It's almost like a mirror image of our own potential. Beautiful eyes, sweet red mouth, hair partially held up in a top knot. The rest held down her back, very clear. Jeweled top knot, five-pointed crown like a tiara. You see it in the pictures and the statues. Necklace around her throat, and then jewels on her upper arms, wrists, ankles. Her right hand holding a blue upala flower between her thumb and ring finger, which are resting on her right knee. In the mudra, this palm is upwards, her right palm is upwards on her knee, fingers pointing down. And in this gesture or mudra of kind of giving, it's a very open, generous gesture, giving realizations. And the blue flower blooms at her right ear. And then her left hand at her heart in the mudra of the three jewels, I think they call it. I forget. The fingers pointing up. And the thumb and ring finger holding the stem of another blue upala flower. This one blooming at her left ear. Everything's made of light. Beautiful. All the qualities of a Buddha, full of wisdom, immense compassion, this power, action, success, courage, cutting through the obstacles, capability. We all need this one. So again, from her brow, she sends these very radiant beams of white laser light that enter our brow, filling us completely, and this time, first, purifying all the rubbish of our bodies, the heaviness, the incapability of the body, the sickness, and all the harm, thinking of, you know, all the karmic imprints of all the harm we've ever done since beginningless time to sentient beings with our bodies. If we think, you know, the Buddha would say we've had countless lives, animals and humans. So really animals, they harm most of the time out of their own fears, their own limited minds, their own ignorance. So much harming. So we think all these countless lives, leaving these countless imprints from our own suffering in the past, our own ignorance, our own fears, harming others as humans as well. So all these imprints of all this harm, gone, annihilated by this blissful white laser light completely filling us. Again, from her brow, she sends these laser beams of white light that enter our brow, filling us instantly, this time with all our marvelous potential. With just this body alone, just imagine the potential to only benefit, incapable of harming any sentient being. Whoever sees us or smells us or touches us only can benefit them with this body. And then, of course, in the long term, the ability of a Buddha to manifest in countless bodies to benefit sentient beings, full of this marvelous potential, this white light. And now from her throat, Lama Tara sends radiant laser beams of red light, penetrating our throat, entering and instantly filling us, first purifying all the nonsense of our speech, all the inappropriate speech, uncontrolled speech, harmful speech, lying, harsh speech, all the rabbiting on about nothing speech that exhausts others and ourselves, and all the speaking behind backs, the harmful speech, criticizing others that creates disharmony and so much suffering. All this negativity, since beginningless time, all the imprints of all this instantly annihilated, eradicated by this blissful red light for us. Again, she sends the red light from her throat, enters our throat, instantly filling us, this time with the potential of the power of speech, as they call it. Most marvelous gift. Such that any sound we utter is of use to whoever hears it. Whether we give talks, whether it is being kind to the next door neighbor, whether we say hello, whoever hears us, whatever sound we speak, necessarily is of benefit to whoever hears in exactly the way they need. Can we imagine this? The power of speech, our own potential, full of this blissful red light filling us. And now from Lama Tara's heart, she sends radiant beams of blue light, blue like the sky, penetrate our heart and fill us instantly, eradicating all the delusions, all this, the ego grasping, the attachment to get what the I wants, the aversion and fears when it doesn't, the jealousy, the low self-esteem, the arrogance. And the fears that come along with this, they are all rooted in fear, it's their nature. All of this that pervades us, that we totally believe is at the core of my being, but which is the source of all our own suffering and the cause of why we harm others, and which is adventitious, which is not at the core of my being. So we visualize this, instantly annihilated by this blissful blue light filling us. And now again from Lama Tara's heart, the heart chakra in the center of her chest, she sends these amazing beams of blue light again, that enter us instantly, filling us now with our potential, which the Buddha would say is at the core of our being, is what defines us, the goodness, the virtue, the kindness, the love, the compassion, wisdom, these qualities. Completely full of this. And therefore, because fears have gone, delusions have gone, full of bliss, our own natural potential for joy and bliss, the natural potential of our mind when it's free of the delusions, full of this bliss and goodness, my own true nature, this amazing blue light filling me. Now this time, Lama Chara sends the three lights together. They say that this first stage is the achievement of our own liberation from suffering, but now we can do even more. We can actually become a Buddha. The three lights together, removing even the subtlest imprints, even the smell of all the delusions, and then from manifesting our own Tara nature. So we think of the white light to the brow, red to the throat, blue to the heart, filling us, eradicating these subtlest imprints to omniscience, as well as manifesting our own Buddha nature, our own Tara nature, full of this blissful energy. So now we imagine that the lotus that Tara is sitting on and the one that her right foot is resting on just dissolve into light up into her body. And then she comes up and sits above our heads, facing the same way as we are. Very happily, wanting to. Become oneness with our body, speech and mind. So you now imagine wanting to become oneness with our body, our speech and our mind. Lama Tara dissolves into green light and merges through our crown and fills us completely with this blissful energy of the Buddha, of the Lama. So my body, speech, mind, Lama's body, speech, mind, Tara's body, speech, mind, same thing. Full of this blissful energy, imagine. So then now just for a couple of minutes, kind of space out in a sense of limitless, blissful, radiant, all-knowing, all-clear Tara mind. Pervading space, no thoughts, just imagine. And then I think, now that I'm the Buddha, this is great for me, but what about sentient beings whom I've worked so hard to become a Buddha to benefit? So I must do my job. So now we visualize them all, friends, enemies, strangers. There's no fourth category. There are those we're attached to, those we have aversion for, and those we don't care about. The ones we're attached to are the ones who do what our attachment want. The ones we have aversion for are the ones who don't do what my attachment wants. And all the strangers, the vast majority, they neither harm me nor help me. So attachment for one lot, aversion for the others, and indifference towards the rest. So right in front, the enemies. You know, you mightn't use that word, but think of the person who irritates you, annoys you, who's upset you. Could be a very strong enemy, could be really could have harmed you, or just the person who annoys you. Put them there, right in front. You know, the current ones. And then to the left, your beloveds, the objects of your attachment, people you adore. Right in front to the left. And then to the right, but everywhere else, above, below, behind, to the sides, as far as your eye can see, all the strangers. And as they, the lamas say, see them all in the form of human beings, which is the form they can get enlightened in, but each of them experiencing their own sufferings, all the realms of existence, full of the whole of space full, all these strangers. So now thinking, they're the same as me, you know, not a fraction of difference. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. Due to delusions and ignorance, they cause themselves and harm others, cause themselves suffering and harm others. We're all in the same boat. So no choice, must benefit them. If I don't, who will? So from our heart, imagine going into all the directions, trillions of tiny green towers, that go out and enter into the hearts of first the enemies, taking away their suffering, giving them their happiness, and then turning them into their Tara. And then the friends and the strangers. Just imagine. And as we continue to visualize this, we just, for a minute, sing the mantra, Tara's mantra. And as we see, the sound goes out, if you like, you can visualize green light coming, raining down, blessing all these beings. Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha. 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 Om Chare Chu Chare Chure 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 Soha. And now we imagine all these transformed Taras dissolving into green light and then all merging, dissolving into our body, enhancing even more brilliantly our own Tara nature. Just finish with that. Okay, relax. So basically the Buddhist teachings are saying, as I've been saying, every thought we have we're planting seeds in the mind. Every thought we have is planting seeds in the mind. So every thought really does count. So you think what we did there, we call it visualization, we call it imagination. But what else is it but thinking, you know? Everything we do every day is just this. We're thinking things, visualizing things, imagining things all the time. You know, that's all. So the Buddha says, all these thoughts. So just these thoughts we just did then, you know? We imagined in front of us the Buddha. We imagined purifying body, speech, and mind. We imagined becoming the Buddha. We imagined benefiting all sentient beings. Stupendous seeds to plant. Every thought you have, if every thought of music you have, you know very well it's producing the musician. It's not random. It's not an accident. The more you think the right thoughts, the more likely you are to become that musician. It's nothing cosmic. Same here. So for this reason alone, you know, if we understand the way karma works from the Buddhist view, it's not as if you get the result now. We treat spiritual practice as something we have to do to bring a result now. So we have a good meditation. We think, oh, I had a really good meditation this morning. What we meant by that is we felt good. Or something occurred. That's great. It's like a bonus. But that's not the sign of success. Not necessarily. You go to the gym and have such pain you can't believe it. But that you were really successful, you know, but it didn't feel good at all. You're sowing the seed to develop this new shapely body, you know, but it was dreadful feeling. So you could sit there having real struggle with your meditation or real struggle in your daily life, arguing and struggling not to get angry. That's practice, you know, if you're really making an effort. So effort is the key to success. And then just knowing every time you do that practice for 1 hour at the piano, it was a struggle, even though you felt lousy, you don't mind. You know you've just put more imprints in the mind to increase your ability to play piano. You know it all counts. Well, it's like that with our thoughts. So have contentment from that, rather than thinking you've got to have some special experience every time. That's just sentimental, you know. Once you understand karma, which is the basic idea that every thought you have sows seeds, then we can be very selective, very precise, very clear, very content. And just a little bit every day, a little bit every day. We're producing the person we want to become. Feeling good's a bonus, but it's not necessarily a sign of success. So again, like I'm saying this morning, we began with the idea, you know, that the one way of presenting in the Tibetan Buddhist teachings, the three principal aspects of the path, that is one way of packaging all these teachings, seeing them in terms of the prerequisites that we need to have in order to want to enter into this type of practice. At least an appreciation for an understanding of this idea of renunciation, which is the first stages of practice, which is knowing which is for your own sake. This is the practice of the what they call the path of individual liberation. The first and second scopes of the Lamrim, or junior school and high school, like I like to call it. So first, controlling your body and speech, abiding by the laws of morality for your sake. You have to know that you're suffering and you're sick of it. This is what renunciation is. We have to know that I'm suffering and I'm sick of it. And now I know the reasons why. And that gives me the basis. That's renunciation. So the first stages of practice are not about compassion. Compassion for yourself, if you like. We've got to have this first. You know, the compassion wing, the bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. You could say the point of the Buddhist approach, this two wings, the compassion wing, that's the political wing, that's the action wing, that's where you get to put your money where your mouth is and you get out and do something to help the world. But it's not enough. It's got to be based on wisdom. It's got to be based most basically on renunciation. So real compassion, genuine compassion, the way we briefly mentioned before, which is the point of the compassion wing, which is the basis of the practice of Tantra. Having the wish to benefit others. Compassion, as I said, you know, is empathy with the suffering of others. So first of all, we have to be clear what that means, isn't it? Empathy, we understand, seeing someone suffering. But already we need to define our terms here, because most of us, when we think that, we think of a person who's a victim, who's being harmed by an oppressor. That's our usual view of suffering, or a person who's very ill, a person who's got the gross level of suffering. So the view here, to really understand the breadth of compassion that Buddha's suggesting we can accomplish, we've got to go right back to junior school, to the renunciation wing, to get to understand what is suffering. If we're having empathy with the suffering of others, we have to know what suffering is, and that's the first stage, is for our own sake. You have to know what suffering is, you have to know what it is, and you have to be sick of it. But the crucial part is, the second part, you have to know what the causes of it are. Then this gives you the basis of wishing to get the hell out of suffering. But let's establish what suffering is. And this is the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha called it different methods, different ways of packaging, but for the Buddha, there's three levels of suffering. The first one, he calls it the suffering of suffering. And this is ordinary, in-your-face suffering. We all know this one. And this is all we mean by suffering. It's basically when the bad things happen. That's what we mean by suffering in our world. That's it. So that's the first level, Buddha says. Suffering of suffering, when the bad things happen. The second one is very depressing initially. It's called, Buddha calls it, the suffering of change. And all he's referring to here is that what we call happiness getting the good things, he calls suffering. Why? Because it turns into the gross suffering, the suffering of change. And this feels kind of unfair. We kind of know that. We know the chocolate cake doesn't last. We know the handsome boyfriend doesn't last. We know that the body, the beautiful, young, fresh body doesn't last. We know nothing lasts. And this is Buddha's basic teaching on impermanence. He didn't make this up, believe me. He doesn't own impermanence. He just observed the truth of it. And this already, too, indicates one of the delusions in our mind, which is grasping at things as permanent. This is just pervasive. So this second kind of suffering, which we call happiness, which is why it's so depressing initially. Buddha sounds so cruel, you know, that even what we call happiness, he calls it a subtler, more pervasive level of suffering. So really, you almost don't know what to do with that, you know. That's why we have to understand what he means logically and then slowly begin to see if there's truth in what he's saying. First one's easy, when the bad things happen, because you think of your life. We spend our entire lives avoiding the first one and trying to get the second one. First is what we call suffering. The second, he calls it the subtle level of suffering. We call it happiness. We spend our lives, is it not, trying to get the nice things and trying to avoid the ugly. That's it. And you look at the world, look at the dogs, the giraffes, the humans. We all did the same thing. We spend our lives trying to get the nice things, which is what we call happiness. Or putting it more precisely, is we're getting what attachment wants. Remember in the second noble truth, two main causes of suffering, both subsuming down to the delusions as the main one, And day-to-day life, effectively, attachment is the main delusion, the main source of suffering. We mentioned already the subtlest delusion is the ego grasping, the clinging to the self, which gives rise to attachment to get to what that self wants. So this attachment, this bottomless pit of dissatisfaction, which we're born with, that then causes us to feel like there's never enough, haven't got enough, therefore got to get something, and the obvious level is the objects of the senses. Then more subtly, getting praise, having people love us, having people, you know, have a good reputation, these things. We'll go into this later. So attachment effectively is the main cause of day-to-day suffering. So in that context, not getting what attachment wants is called suffering for us, and getting what attachment wants is called happiness for us. The Buddha calls the one gross suffering, the suffering of suffering, and he calls getting what attachment wants a subtler level of suffering. So why is it called this? Like I said, he calls it simply the suffering of change. But that doesn't sound very convincing to us. We know it. We know happiness doesn't last. We absolutely know that. But it feels really unkind of him to point it out, like as if he's being mean to you, you know? Because it's all we know. So we know it doesn't last. We know the cake becomes ugly. We know the person, not always, but, you know, certainly they'll die on us one day, so it's certainly going to change. We know this, but it feels a bit distressing to think that this is even this is what's called suffering. It's very hard to see. In other words, and it seems interesting here that we have to put it in context for the Buddha. Why he's pointing out to us what we call happiness, which is when attachment gets what it wants, which is the samsaric happiness, and don't think of it as religious, he's talking practically, that actually, he says, it's heartbreaking because it's not really happiness. It's this temporary respite from the gross suffering, that's all. It's like a junkie getting the fix. Anybody with half a brain seeing an alcoholic or a junkie can see that, you know, all it's doing is a respite from the intensity of the suffering of the craving. So you calm it down for a second. But we know that what it really does is increase the craving, increase the level of suffering. My mother used to say, the more you get, the more you want. So this is the key to understanding why getting what attachment wants is nothing other than suffering, by understanding the cause of it is attachment. But it just takes time to see it because it's so ingrained in us, so automatic, so spontaneous. We're so addicted to this method. But we know it changes. So what Buddha's doing here is letting us know, what he's comparing this with, and this is where it sounds so holy to us, he's comparing it with suffering, with happiness, that he says we do have the potential to accomplish, which doesn't change into suffering. Real simple. What he is saying is that each being, every mind, possesses the potential, putting it in simple terms, to be blissfully content, blissfully happy, blissfully joyful. That's what he's saying. That's speaking simply, that's nirvana. Speaking simply. Mind, cessation, nirvana means cessation, liberation, cessation of suffering and its causes. So what Buddha is saying is, these delusions we've been talking about are not at the core of our being, they're adventitious. That mind in its nature is fundamentally clear and pure, which means we have the potential to experience purity and clarity. That the virtuous states of mind, you could say, are in the nature of this clarity, pretty much. And that when you finally remove the pollution from the mind, which is the delusions, the neuroses, the misconceptions, the fears, the dramas, the nonsense, the lies, when you remove those, what's left is a blissful, happy mind. What's left is your blissful, happy mind, which is in the nature of virtue, in the nature of goodness, in the nature of bliss. It's a natural state, not like some reward that someone gives you for being a good girl. It's not something you get when you go to heaven. It is a psychological process. This is Buddha's point. So, of course, in our culture, there's no state like this that's considered to be attainable. We say anger's normal, jealousy's normal, ego's normal, fear's normal. As long as you haven't got too much of it, you're an okay person. That's how we think. We're allowed to think that, but Buddha's got this really radically different view. You know, and it's so important to hear it in real, ordinary psychological terms, not some mystical idea, you know. This is what Buddha's making, this point, that this happiness that we have now, which basically is like the happiness of a junkie, because attachment's like a junkie, basically. That's what he's saying. We're all junkies, it's a question of degree, and I'm not kidding, it's a good way to put it. Attachment is the junkie mind. And when it gets what it wants, that's what we call happiness, and that's what we're craving every microsecond. So the method we use to get happiness is attachment. What we think happiness is, Buddha says, is what we get when we get what attachment wants. But what he's saying is, what happiness is what you get when you give up attachment. So I have to think about it. Think about it. We have to think about it. And look into what he means by this. Analyze these words. What is attachment in its nature? Look at Buddhist psychology. You don't just hear the words cute and nice and believe them. His other writer is wrong. We have to look into it. This is the basis. So what's hard here, though, is this, you know. I remember one time when I was working with people in prison, often the prisoners, they would write to us. We had letters from prisoners and we'd visit them and send them things and blah, 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 and have people write. And so this first prisoner who ever wrote to us, young Mexican, Arturo, who was sitting in his little cell from the age of 16, 18 or something, 16, in prison since he was 12, basically, gangster in Los Angeles. Then adult prison from the time he was 16, 3 life sentences. Then in the gang activity in all the prisons in California, all these gangs, right? So then he was sent to the security, which is thousands of people in these prisons, in these cells, where they're in their cell 23 hours a day, with another hour up and down in another cell, you know, no light, no air, no sun, you know, neon lights, noise like you can't conceive, 10 books, the inside of a pen, because you could use the outside to stab your cellmate, you'd use a hardback to whack your cellmate, so they have paperbacks, and if you have the money, you can get a television and eat and speakers, in a small cell, smaller than most bathrooms. Bathrooms, not toilets, bathrooms, with no windows, 8 foot by 10 foot or something. And you live in there 23 hours a day. I mean, they kill each other regularly. You would, wouldn't you? Spending with your best friend, yellow jumpsuit, in a room with bright lights, noise like you can't imagine, screaming 23 hours a day, 20 hours a day, 3 hours of quiet, maybe. 10 books, the inside of a pen, and that's it. Kind of intense. So anyway, there he is in this prison. He writes to Lama Zopa, and Rinpoche writes back, basically saying, your prison is nothing in comparison with the inner prison of ordinary people. Well, I'm sorry to tell you, but that's us. And we didn't think we were in prison, did we? We thought we were free. The inner prison. And this is why it takes time. Lama Yeshe said, I can tell you about attachment for one whole year. You'll never begin to understand it. And until you start looking deeply into your own mind. It just takes time. Because what we think of attachment is actually pleasure, good things. We don't identify a state so precise in the way Buddha does in Buddhist psychology for this state of mind. We don't isolate it and identify it, you know. So attachment, for us, as long as it's getting what it wants, then we call that happiness. And the fact is, this inner prison, as Rinpoche articulated, the prison of attachment, the prison of depression, the prison of anger, we can see ourselves when we start getting distressed. That's when we go kill ourselves. Who do you think kills themselves? Who are those 800,000 people in 2010 who killed themselves? You know, when you get distressed, when things go wrong, when the husband leaves you, when the husband kills you. The biggest number of murders on this earth is women at the hands of men, their partner, not a stranger. So when things get distressing, when attachment stops getting what it wants, and then the anger arises, the fears, the dramas, the depression, the low self-esteem, the rage, the pride, the arrogance, look what happens, you know, complete mental breakdown. Ordinary people like you and me. So the point about this, for these prisoners that I know in prison, on death row, in their little ugly cells, you know, with life sentences, won't get out of prison alive. They either go mad, or they accept this is their reality, and then they change their mind, because you can't change anything else. So we are in the have the illusion that I'm happy and free, you know, because I can get my tea when I want it, my coffee when I want it, there's money in the bank, I have a house, I have good friends, you know. So it's like, and this is where it sounds so cruel, because basically what Buddha's saying, and this really does need looking at, that what propels us 100% of the time is this attachment, this yearning to get what I want every single second. So just check one day when you don't get what you want that often. The traffic is lousy, the husband's mean, the kids are shouting, you've got a pain in the knee, you've got a terrible headache, work is ugly, the lights are red, you get home, you're totally drained and exhausted, isn't it? Just because small things happen. Forget about being, you know, accused of murder and you didn't murder and you're on death row. Forget about being a 30-year sentence for having a marijuana. Forget about, you know, being wrongly accused. Forget about being in these insane asylums. Just forget about that level of suffering. But just merely not having a few things go well in a day. I'm not trying to be mean about us. It just shows the subtlety, it's all, of attachment and the subtlety of understanding happiness, of understanding what we mean by happiness, but what Buddha calls suffering. So then, because we can get what we want fairly easily, so we keep pursuing it. So when I need another cup of tea, I'll get a cup of tea. But if I'm in prison, I might want a cup of tea, but I have no choice. I can't get a cup of tea. So either the moment attachment doesn't get what it wants, that usually is the start of anger, depression, panic, rage, hurt. So as long as we can get what we want every second, we'll keep thinking we're happy. Don't hear this as cruel, it's quite subtle. Don't say, it doesn't mean you can't get your nice cup of tea. Please get your nice cup of tea. I'm so happy for you. But the second our attachment needs, now, you know, I move. You know, my body's a bit, so I'll move. I just satisfy what attachment. I just gave attachment what it wanted. I move my leg, you know. Or I want water, I'll take my mouthful. I'm a bit tired, I'll go to sleep. I'll get up because I'm now not tired. I'll have a bath because I need a nice rest. I'll read my iPad and I'm bored. I'll have every second, ordinary things we do, mostly they're propelled by attachment, Buddha says. We don't notice this. It's so subtle, so subtle, so subtle. So when attachment doesn't get what it wants, that's the only time that we know we even have attachment. And that's why if we can get what we want every second, we're so fortunate, but all we're doing is feeding attachment and never looking at it. Never looking at it, never noticing. So it's really quite subtle. It's quite hard to see that this is suffering. And like I said, it sounds kind of cruel, you know, because we just think it's normal. So the people I know in prison, just for example, because they can't get what their attachment wants. They just can't. They live in these dumps. They're treated like animals. You've got a small bathroom to live in. That's it. Food. My friend, the Mexican friend, he said, "Rabina, is broccoli yellow?" I mean, it gets yellow broccoli at least. I can't describe to you some of the things. Never mind. It's just a really simple example, you know. Your prison is nothing in comparison with the inner prison of ordinary people. And the point is, these people I know who are practicing in prison, they know it's true. Because they can't do anything but work on their mind. But we have constantly the next cup of tea to have, the next job, the next friend, the next movie, the next this. So we keep, you know, getting the fix every day. Millions of fixes, pleasant fixes, you know. The friend, the movie, the sleep, the warmth, the cool, the this, the tea, the coffee. Just ordinary things. But we're not realizing it's propelled by attachment. It's quite subtle, hard to see. So these guys, mostly the guys I know, who are, you know, unbelievable. They're forced. A friend of mine on death row, Mitch, he's getting close to his death date. Well, I have to do an advertisement, I'm sorry, that movie out there. There's a movie out there, Chasing Buddha, my nephew made years ago, and now he's offering me 50% of the profit from it, so whatever. Anyway, it's very moving because some part of the film is these people on death row in Kentucky. It's very moving, and he's one of the people, this guy, I saw him recently, Mitch, and he's getting ready for his death date. And he said, "Rabina, I'm ready for that electric jolt, you know." He lives in his own cell, he wears a red jumpsuit in this with about 40 other guys on death row. Garbage dump lives, you know. Be depressing anybody, but concrete, ugly, metal, ugly world. Many of the psychos, you know. But he just decided years ago this is his life. He transformed his mind. He gave up blame, gave up guilt, gave up fear, gave up neurosis, regretted what he did. And he's just a really funny, wonderful, happy human being living in his red jumpsuit, waiting for death to come, you know. So, I mean, I just can't help but have respect. So he's actually freed his mind, you know. And look at us, and the smallest thing goes wrong. This is not a joke to say the inner prison of ordinary people. It's not a joke to say that, you know. But it really takes courage to look. It's the subtlety of attachment, the depths of attachment. The depths of attachment, you know. Ordinary sentient, it's ordinary mind for us in the West. For the Buddha, it's a terrible mental illness. Amazova says, you've got renunciation of suffering and its causes. You know you're suffering, first kind, second kind. Haven't mentioned the third kind yet. That's even more subtle. First kind and second kind. You know you're suffering, and now you know the causes. Karma and delusions, karma and delusions, karma and delusions. We'll go to this more. We've said it briefly today. And the two of these bring renunciation. You're so exhausted from suffering, you can't bear the thought of another moment, so you know you want to practice to change, giving up attachment, giving up delusions. So, as Amazova says, you've got renunciation when just the thought of another moment of attachment is so disgusting. He uses various analogies. One is, it's like so disgusting, it's like using used toilet paper. That's one. But the other one, he says, is like being in a septic tank. So for us, it's like a joke, because we don't think of, you know, if you think of an ordinary person like yourself with an ordinary life, nice things, nice house, money in the bank, you know, friends, this, support, a good life. It is a good life, and you're a good person. To think that this prison we are in is worse than the prison of being in a prison, it just seems bizarre to us, you know. This is where, having understood this in the first stages of practice with renunciation, we then want to develop renunciation for it. Then we want to develop bodhicitta to benefit others, and then we want to realize emptiness to get the hell out of it, which is how we've talked a little bit. Having all this, then okay, then we're making the most of this life. But just at the level of attachment, ordinary life, ordinary happiness, Buddha says, and we're utterly unaware. As Lama Zopa says, most beings on this earth don't even know that their mind plays any role at all. So anyway, kind of interesting. So renunciation. You've got to know what suffering is. You've got to know what suffering is, and then you've got to be sick of it. Well, we just mentioned the first two kinds. I haven't mentioned the third one yet, which is called all-pervasive suffering. We don't even go there. Okay, it's even more subtle. So first knowing what suffering is, the three kinds, and then being exhausted by it, being sick of it, and knowing finally the causes of it, which is the second noble truth, my past actions. Remember this view of Buddhas, that every sentient being is creator of their own realities. From life after life after life after life after life after life. It's not punishment, it's not reward, there's no one up there pulling the strings, and it's not random. It's a natural law that runs itself. Karma takes care, as Lama Yeshe would say. So karma and delusions are the cause of suffering. My past actions based upon delusions, which ripen as my suffering, and then it keeps the ball rolling, you know. So once I've got this down, sick of suffering, know what suffering is, I know the causes, that's renunciation. Then I'm going to go, I'm exhausted by this, I want to give it up, and then I practice. That's renunciation. So now I've got that. That's the basis of compassion. So now I can open my eyes and say, oh my God, look at this world. And not only do I see the victims, because they're the only ones we have compassion for now. We have compassion for victims, usually children and animals. That's about the extent of it. Or our people, you know. But here with this view of what suffering is, every sentient being suddenly fits. When you realize that every sentient being, for the Buddha, is either experiencing the fruit of their past negative actions or is causing future suffering by following negative actions now. So even more reason to have compassion for the naughty ones. Even more reason to have compassion, like those two young nuns, for those torturers. Which doesn't mean, as you know, we're saying here, oh, you just kind of, you know, oh, it's karma and let people suffer. On the contrary, you have such compassion for others, but you've got to have it for yourself first. That's renunciation. We'd say it's like having compassion for yourself. In other words, when you really know the suffering of being an alcoholic, for example, you really have compassion for other people because you've been through it. So when you know what causes you suffering, that's your basis of compassion. So then you're going to have compassion not just for the innocent victims, because there's no such thing. but you'll have unbearable compassion, as Lama Zofa puts it, for the people causing suffering. This is really a tough one for our mind, but it's logical based on the view of karma. Because the victim is just finishing their suffering. The perpetrator is just beginning their suffering. And we've all been in these roles, Buddha says, life after life after life after life. This is the tragedy. So it's a bit like, you know, when you see others causing suffering, you have compassion for them because you realize they're causing themselves suffering as well as harming other people. Of course you try to stop them, but for their sake as well. And that's a tough one for us, because our view of suffering is people get born, no one asks to get born, it's not my fault, and then you get harmed, wrongly. And our view of suffering is, you know, that it's you have to be an innocent victim. Because if I punch you in the nose and you punch me back, no one will have compassion for me. I deserve it. But if you see me be punched, I didn't punch you, you're prepared to have compassion for me. So for us, compassion is based upon innocent victims. Buddha says it's just a misconception. There's no such thing as an innocent victim. It's a misconception. So it's a tough one. It's a big one. Think about it carefully, you know. Therefore, when you've got renunciation, this is the basis of you having compassion for others. So renunciation is one, I'm sick of suffering, the three kinds. Two, now I know why. Now you transfer that to others. Oh my God, look at sentient beings harming themselves. All the maniacs, all the terrorists, all the evils, all the liars, all the stealers, all the killers, all the rapists. Look at them. Causing suffering to other people, unbearable, and to themselves in the countless future lives. And why? Because they're the victims of the past. They become the oppressors of the present. It's like this cosmic, terrible joke. Of course I have compassion for them. Unbearable. And for the victims, who will then be the oppressors of next life. And so it keeps going. So one, you see the suffering, you find it unbearable. And two, you know why they're suffering, their karma and their delusions. That's the basis of real compassion. And then you become this brave bodhisattva. If I don't help them, who will? So you've got to have renunciation first, junior school, high school. That gives rise to genuine compassion. And then you've got to put emptiness into the mix, because that cuts the ego completely, qualifies us. And that's what causes us to become the Buddha, you know. So, have to think about it. Takes time. Time to go home. 5:00. Any questions before you finish? Any questions? It's dark already. Look, it's winter, isn't it? Any questions? Yes, sweetheart. What, my darling? I know, I didn't discuss. The third kind of suffering, the first kind of suffering is called the suffering of suffering. When your attachment doesn't get what it wants and it's upsetting and, you know, bad things happen. The second kind of suffering, which is caused by attachment, is when the good things happen. But the third kind of suffering is called all-pervasive suffering. So let me try and explain. If we use attachment as our analogy, then the first kind of suffering is you can't get the junk. And it's like unbearable pain, unbearable suffering, anguish, desperate, frantic, terrible, terrible, terrible suffering. The second kind of suffering is when you get the junk. And the third kind of suffering is being born in a body of a junkie, in a world constructed of junk, and in order to survive, you need to ingest junk every day. You kind of haven't got a choice. Your very nature is defined by it. That's all pervasive suffering. Only way I can describe it, if that makes any sense. It doesn't, I know, I see. Silence. It's Buddha's view of what samsara is. It's so very different from ours. This view, this universe we live in is one of the only, you know, there's countless universes, countless sentient beings, and it's driven by attachment. It's caused by attachment. We're caught up, we're living in this body of desire in a universe made of the objects of desire. Is it not true that the universe as we know it is the objects of our attachment? Is it not? It's the objects of the five senses, isn't it? The world is made of the five sense objects. You just deprive yourself for one day, you go insane, right? So just an ordinary level of an ordinary life, we crave, we yearn at the grossest level to fulfill the needs of the senses. Wouldn't you agree? So to be deprived of that would be like a total utter nightmare, utterly gone mad. So just to survive, we have to fulfill the needs of the senses. Just to survive, we have to keep getting the fix, you know? And it's all based upon attachment. So, of course, we have to understand that the reference point here is that this universe is the, what caused it, even what causes to have these bodies with these types of the five holes that demand feeding and causes to be born in a world that you feed the senses with. This is all the product of our past attachment. So we sort of set ourselves up in this nightmares that we've created. It's a very different view. Okay. Suffering of suffering, suffering of change, all pervasive suffering. So way to go, babies. I mean, like, way to go, you know. What else? Any other questions before we go home? What, sweetheart? Oh, darling, are you coming back tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay, we'll have to do it tomorrow. More tomorrow, more emptiness tomorrow. It's emptiness tomorrow. We have to do that. 5:05.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. So we just sing a wee prayer to finish, a tiny prayer, a little prayer, baby prayer. It's just saying, may compassion grow and grow in the hearts of all. It takes 30 seconds. Jung chob sem chog rinpoche, ma kye pa nam ke gyu chik, kye pa nyam pa me pa yang, gong ne gong du pa wa shuk. Oh, my voice is gone. Okie doke, goodbye, thank you, see some of you tomorrow. Very kind, everybody. Bye bye. Oh, the city, if one comes to say hello, you come say hello.